happy Shabbat to one and all. Welcome to Yadaya Radio. We're here with the normal cast, and we've got Larry and Kirk. We also have a fellow named Blake on the line, and I didn't see JB in the queue, but if he's there, he knows how to work the switchboard and chime in. How are you guys doing?
Doing great, thank you. How are you?
I want to start with just a couple of items in the news. One is that this week, the German government told its citizens to stock up so that they have at least 2 to 4 weeks of basic supplies, water, food, batteries, your basic necessities. They said it's all so that you can be prepared to harbor the military, which means they get to stay in your house, and so that you can endure not a natural disaster, but a major event that will involve the military in Germany. And then they began to debate whether or not they should reactivate the draft, conscription.
Wow.
Now, why do you think the German government is embarking on a war stance?
Russia? America trying NATO,
no,
trying to attack Russia?
There is zero chance that Russia is going to invade Germany.
Is anybody trying to sail, though?
I don't know. It's the biggest military, of course, in Europe, and I thought it was just fascinating that they were taking a war stance. The other thing that was just interesting is today there was a feature editorial in the Washington Post that came to the conclusion that the Clinton Foundation exists for a singular purpose, and that is the enrichment of Bill and Hillary Clinton, and so that Bill and Hillary Clinton can live in terms of airplanes and hotels and homes and the like in the manner that they have become accustomed after the White House, because they were dead broke prior to the White House, and that it exists strictly to fund their lifestyle, and that most of the funds into the Clinton Foundation come from foreign entities, and most of them were to set up meetings either with Obama or with the Hillary Clinton when she was Secretary of State. Now, back in the day, if you go back about 10 years, they would call that bribery. That was a crime.
Yes. Be treason, a lot of them, roughly.
You mean to tell me you don't think Bill's worth $600,000 a speech? I'm sorry. You're blowing by me here, you know.
Yeah, well, you know, the predecessor, both of the Bushes, and I speak to you today in Bush country, both Bushes, their first speech was $25 million courtesy of the Saudi Arabians. And for the Saudi Arabians to pay $25 million for them to give a speech, that's a bribe. All they did is they said, listen, you can't write me a check, and I can't acquiesce to your whims while I'm president, but you can arrange to have me give a speech. You can pay me anything that the traffic will bear. $25 million sounds like a good number to me. And
$25 million? I didn't know that. $25 million?
I'd like to get a copy of that speech.
Wow.
One stirring speech.
Well,
you must learn a lot there.
Yeah. Yes.
He was probably to an empty room when he just walked in and said hello.
Yes, like Hillary and Bill Clinton, they both got $8 to $10 million advances on their books. It was nothing but a setup.
Sure.
Well,
it is
astonishing
that we can have an election like the one that we have now, or a world that is this close to being on the precipice of literally falling apart. I mean, can you imagine having a president of the United States whose primary purpose for being in public office is to fund their foundation for their own personal lifestyle?
Yeah, I can imagine it. It's happening. You know, I mean,
yeah.
What do you suppose will be done about it? Because here's my guess. Nothing. That's my guess. Now,
you
have a different opinion.
The Washington Post, when they wrote the article, were even more scathing than what my summation here is, and they said that what has happened to America when obvious impropriety, where they are taking money for access just because there isn't yet a direct link between paying hundreds of thousands of dollars and sometimes millions of dollars. The meeting, which there's lots of links between the payment and the meeting, but then number three, the next step is then the Clinton somehow working to facilitate whatever it was that their patron desired. So that it goes, that's the new legal test to arrest somebody and convict them for bribery. But you have everything else.
But they go to see
they won't.
Yeah.
For weeks they've been playing the, it's called Clinton Cash. It's a documentary on all this. There's also another book, but I can't remember the name of it. Of another author who wrote a book on the same thing. Only he did it from the financial standpoint, like the pretty much like the guy who got Bernie Madoff. You know, he went through the details of the financial statements, and it's undisputed. I mean, you couldn't argue on their behalf.
No, you can't. WikiLeaks is coming out too in October with a whole bunch of more leaked emails where, you know, he's drawn a bunch of conclusions. I did read that. So, I mean, it's an ongoing thing. Everybody knows it, and everybody seems to be powerless to do anything about it, which is why we don't do politics, you know, other than expose
them.
No,
we talk about it to expose and condemn it.
Yeah.
But we don't vote.
Well, I look at something as pathetic as this, as obvious as this, And it's almost, you know, in your face theft. And then I see a guy like Don Trump, who's supposed to be the new savior. You know, he's going to save the masses from the political actors. And he looks like he's just out there. And this is the first week I've watched any of his speeches. I don't know who wrote them. I don't know if it's his delivery. I don't know what it is. He sounds terrible. He sounds like a guy that's out there looking to lose. That's what he looked like to me, which sort of surprised me about the guy, to be honest. But
yeah, he's horrible.
I guess it shouldn't have been a surprise.
There is no connection between his brain and his mouth. And yet he is by far the better candidate. He's not.
Oh yeah.
He's an idiot, but he's not a thief.
You know, you just said it, and they need a thief in there. I mean, if the guy doesn't need money, how are they going to get to him?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, the guy that the only person that's credible is Johnson, the libertarian. He is. I don't know if any of you all have gone and. You should Google his video. His name is Johnson. He's a libertarian running for president. And he and his vice president candidate basically have this, it's like a 5-minute video. And I think it plays on YouTube. And it basically says, okay, America, what do you have to lose? Look at the two clowns that are running from the major parties.
Yeah, this election might be the best example of why we need a third party.
Yeah, it said both of them said, you know, we were elected and reelected governors in staunchly Democratic states, and yet we're Republicans. We balanced the budget, we enhanced the schools, we lowered unemployment, all the things that America says it wants, we did in a Democratic state as Republicans, and we're reelected. And you know, we're opposed to America being at war with everybody. We're opposed to the entitlement mentality, and these two guys are just saying, "So, America, what do you got to lose?"
Well, no, that's you know, profound. If you think about what they said, it's profound. But that's why,
of course, what the Libertarian Party is, it has nothing to do with liberal. It means liberty in the sense of liberty from government. It's liberty.
Yeah, like a Jeffersonian liberal, you mean.
And their view is that the less government, the better government.
Well, that's my view, too. You know, so that's Yahweh's view as well, really.
No government other than the Torah would be just fine with Yahweh.
Right.
Yep.
That's exactly
right. It's interesting. He is, and Yeshayah, he was really quite clear. He is going to reappoint his judges.
Yeah.
And, you know, judge like is from Shabbat. It's the basis of, you know, Mishpat is the just means to resolve disputes. Shapat, which is the Hebrew word for judge, means to examine the evidence and make a rational and moral decision. And so he says, I'm going to bring them back. So during the millennial Shabbat, we'll have the judges again. And, you know, what they basically do is they say, all right, you've got two people. They have a dispute. We're going to make a decision based upon the Constitution, which is the Torah. And we'll resolve the conflict if two people or two parties disagree. As for me,
because I had that thought watching all the nonsense. And I could take about an hour and a half of it, and then all I really saw was spin from both sides, okay? But, the people that were talking about the Clintons, they were straight up, and then they always had a spin doctor there. You can't prove anything. There's no direct line side. There's, you know, this type of nonsense. When, you know, you accidentally end up with, you know, $100 million in your pocket just by accident. You know how easy that accident happens. And
you leave
so,
the White House,
you know,
and you're dead broke, and now you're worth hundreds of millions of dollars.
Yeah. And I'm sitting there watching that, though.
And by the way, you haven't built anything. You haven't invested anything. You don't have any business. You haven't created anything.
Well, they're on a big watch list.
From broke to hundreds of millions of dollars.
Their charity is on a big watch list because apparently they've done nothing but put $1,000 in here and a couple thousand there and thrown in some mosquito nets or something for Africa or something. Just ridiculous stuff when you've got hundreds of millions of dollars. But I was thinking exactly that. I was thinking, how much nicer and how refreshing would it be that somebody would actually judge things vis-a-vis the Torah? And then I thought about the people, because I used to be, like you, a constitutionalist. And I thought, you know, people today, you know, there's the freedom group that run around, and all they do is they wave a Roman flag while they talk about wanting freedom, by the way. And they go out there and they say, you know, we got to get back to the Constitution, and they're always quoting Jefferson, and they're always quoting the Constitution. And I think to myself, you know, these people have actually bought into something that they shouldn't have, because they're buying into the idea that the Constitution was written and is defended by God. They really are.
Yeah, I know.
And nothing could be further from the truth. I mean, it's just another lie.
Yeah, I've just finished the first 100 pages, as you guys know, of the 10th chapter of Observations. We're going to return to the 6th chapter for tonight's program. But in that chapter, I had a reason to go through every conversation that Yahweh had with Abraham and walk through each of the things that he asked with him. And, you know, there are five very specific requirements to participate in the covenant. And, of course, that first one shows God's overall disdain for man's institutions. Walk away from your country. Walk away from Babel. Walk away from societal customs, and walk away from the family of man, and do those things to God. So you're leaving the politics and religion and customs of man to approach God. And until you're willing to do that, until you see why these things are counterproductive, God won't even talk to you. But it is interesting that we did. I mean, when I went through this, I began to look at what God did relative to Abraham, which was the same thing he did with Moshe, which is what he's done with most of us. Most of us were introduced to God, where he met us somewhere along the way, where we had shown a disdain for either government, politics, or religion, or both, and we're headed in the right direction. We just need a little guidance. And that's exactly what he did with Abraham. Abraham was already headed out, but he met him halfway. And he didn't even meet him in Babylon, which is interesting. You know, that whole conversation where he says, I want you to walk away from your country, from the societal customs, and from Babel, essentially, and from your father's house. That conversation took place in Haran, not in Babylon. So Abraham had already left Babylon and was headed in the right direction when they met. But that is the standard operating procedure. I think God realizes that as bad as things are on this planet now, if he doesn't introduce himself to some people along the way, he's going to have a really small family.
Well, there'd be no place to walk to here. You understand? I mean, you're kind of hemmed in. It's sort of global now. There, you know, if I thought that Yahweh wanted me to walk physically, go somewhere else, I would do it. I really would.
Yeah.
And I've looked at it, and it doesn't appear to me.
No.
You know, just like the Tarua train's the
again,
only one out.
Every aspect of the Abraham story is precise. If God physically wanted you to walk out of your country, then he would have met with Abraham in Babylon. He didn't meet with Abraham in Babylon. He met with him in Haran. And therefore, what he is saying when he said, I want you to walk away from your country, it's symbolic. It's the whole idea of disassociating yourself from politics and religion, because the man had already walked away from his country. You know, when he said, I want you to walk away from your father's house? Well, guess what? When Yahweh met with him, his dad had died.
Yeah, that's right.
So it's not physically separating from your father's house. It's the symbolic of separating from the family of man. I mean, whose
family
is going
to be part
of? Yeah,
well, house is typically a religion, by the way, too. I mean,
so it's all symbolic of this is what you're supposed to. It's not a physical. It's, you know, put on your shoes and walk. It's think about this, and it's your attitude.
Well, no, I brought that up because there are people that literally think that. You know, when you've turned your back on Babylon, we know you've turned your back on, you know, traditions, societal traditions and norms, your government, the country, the religions your country embraces. We know this, and that's what he's really talking about. If I thought there was a place that I should go, I would go there. But there's nowhere to escape to begin with.
Yeah, he's not telling you to walk physically. You
know, I know. That's my point.
Texas,
yeah.
This evening, he's not telling you to walk away from Waco, Texas, to to Denver, Colorado. It has nothing to do with your physical proximity. It has all to do with your attitude. And he makes that abundantly clear. That's why it's just so interesting. If you take the time, which is what I did, this 10th chapter is already 100 pages, and I haven't made it through the 7th meeting yet. But what I've done is just each time God says something, I just, okay, let's just stop, and let's think about, this is what he said, this is when he said it, this is the context of it, this was the consequence of it. And when you think of things like you're just talking about, I would go someplace if there was a place to walk away from America. He's not asking you to do that. He's asking you to, from an attitude point of view, to no longer be engaged in politics, to no longer be engaged in the babble of religion, to don't participate in the societal customs. If they're going to play the national anthem, you find an excuse that you're not standing up at attention with your hand over your heart. If they're going to do the Pledge of Allegiance, don't do it. And so it's an attitude thing. It's not a proximity thing.
But it's also, now there's another aspect to it, too. All the way through his words, do you remember when we were talking about the ants? Be like the ants, or be like a bird. Quickly go in and make a few statements and just go away. He's talking about that, too. And, of course, if everybody had walked out of Babylon, you know, mentally, you wouldn't have to be doing that. So clearly he knows we're going to be surrounded by people that are still in Babylon, correct?
Well,
he knows that.
That's the vast majority. 999,999 out of every 1 million are still in Babylon. You know, the primary issue with the ant, and he used two things, and this is now in Proverbs 6. And what he said about the ant, he says, I want you to pay attention to the ant because the ant has no government. The ant has no leader. The ant has no foreman. There isn't any boss. They all work harmoniously together, but there is no hierarchy. And he says, so that's the story of the ant. In fact, we have sciences. If you study the ant, there is, in an ant colony, there is no hierarchy. Even the queen has no authority over any of the ants. So he says, you ought to be such that you don't show an affinity for power. And the second thing he said is that the end is prepared. During the summer, when the getting is good, when there's plenty of food, the ant stores away the food for the winter when there isn't so much food. And as we know, every time God speaks of food, it has nothing to do with food, ever. When he's talking about food, it's always about if you are properly nourished, if you're nourished on the things that matter, like the Torah, you're going to be healthy and thrive. If you are nourished by and consume the things of man and religion and politics, you are going to be screwed. And every time he talks about food, it's in exactly that same venue. So he's saying, you know, we have not a lot of time. It's 2016, 10 years or so. We're looking at the beginning of the tribulation and the Teruah harvest. We don't have a lot of time. This would be a really good time to store up, to be as nourished as we could possibly be, to be as prepared as we could possibly be in terms of Yahweh's testimony, so that we're not taken by surprise, so we're not found lacking and devoid of what we need. Because it's going to get rough out there.
I think you're spelling quicker than I could even imagine. It's economic reports today, all that stuff. We are collapsing.
Yeah, well, absolutely. About the economic
what is going on in Germany? What is going on in Germany? You said this is the first I've even heard of it. There's so much news that comes out.
They're preparing for war in Germany.
Or with whom?
You know what I think? What they're doing. I think that the right-wing anti-immigrant group in Germany is so up in arms over the millions of Muslims that they have brought in, and the Muslims have been so bad in terms of thievery and rape and the like that what I read was the German government is expecting anarchy. They're expecting
their
own
people to get
to revolt against the Angela Merkel government, and that they're going to turn the military against their own people. That's what they're expecting. When I read the article said nothing about that.
That's the only thing I could think, too. That's the only thing I could think. I mean, I don't know if it was Dennis Tracy or who it was, I think it was Dennis, somebody had presented a picture today where there were four Muslims, probably in their 20s. Maybe it wasn't Dennis, I'm not sure, but they were holding a cat's head, smiling, and the cat had been beheaded. You know, imagine, you know, you've got your family pet or dog, cat, whatever, and you got these four people smiling, taking selfies. How they
yeah,
well,
give you another example here. In Australia, yesterday, a Muslim man hacked to death a girl that would not go out with him. He wanted to date this girl. He's a Muslim. She's not a Muslim, and he went after her with a knife, and he hacked her to death. And while he was hacking her to death, he was screaming "Allahu Akbar." Allah is greater. It means greater than Yahweh. And so the police and the Justice Department in Australia said this had nothing to do with Islam. It was a domestic dispute. So you've got a girl that won't go out with somebody, and he hacks her and everyone around her to death with a knife screaming Allahu Akbar, and you think that the Islamic perception of men own women and that women are property doesn't play into that equation?
No, I had nothing to do with that. No.
That's called check your brain at the door. Yeah, of course. I mean, that's insane. It's an ongoing, you know, media myth. You wrote about it in, way back in Prophet of Doom.
Yeah.
Craig. I mean, you know, when you laid out that the media, they're covering all the time, you know, is that everything's a gray area. Right? I mean, that's their shtick, really.
Yeah, they have no ability to find a common denominator. But let's return to Yashaya 1:10 is the general area we left off last time. We spent an entire program, of course, last week speaking of the timing and the purpose of the Shabbat and the timing of the Shabbat, as well as the timing of the Mikra and Mikrei. But let's turn to Yashaya 1:10. This is the next statement that God has. He says, choose to listen to the word. Almost everything God says about the covenant and about his Torah and about his prophets is based on free will. So this is Shama Dabar, so choose to listen to the word. But it is written in the imperative mood. The imperative mood is second person volition. So it's the listener, the person being spoken to. Choose to listen to the word of Yahweh. Now, the word of Yahweh doesn't say the word of God, certainly doesn't say the Lord's word, doesn't say the Bible, doesn't say the New Testament. There was no New Testament. In fact, as I was translating the section on circumcision in chapter 10, the word that God used to describe the consequence of being opposed to circumcision as the sign of the covenant, he used parar. And what parar means is that I'm going to say that you broke and violated and nullified the benefits of my covenant because you chose to create a second one. So his complaint against those who are not circumcised is that they have chosen a new and different covenant. Do you know anybody that was opposed to circumcision that created a new covenant?
Apollos.
Yeah, it would be Paul. Yeah, and so it was specifically on that. But anyway, this says, choose to listen to the word of Yahweh, and the word of Yahweh would be the Torah, the prophets, and the Psalms, full stop. It's still the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, and nothing more. Leaders of Sodom. He's referring now to Yehuda and Yisrael as Sodom, the scorched and burning. And listen intently, perceiving what is said, and then respond appropriately. You know, it's interesting that in Hebrew, there are five or six words for observe. There are five or six words for listen. The primary word for listen is just, you know, use your ears, your perception of hearing, and listen to what's being said. And that's shama. It's used all the time. But sometimes he uses a different word. This happens to be azan. And any time there's two different words used to communicate the same concept in English, it's always important to look at, well, what's unique about the less used word. And in this case, the thing that's unique about azan is respond, and respond appropriately. So shama just means listen. And azan means not just listen, but listen in such a way that you're equipped to make a rational decision and that you respond appropriately based upon what's being said. Now, in this particular case, Yahweh was very clear that that his word that he was recommending that his people who are now had rejected him listen to was the Torah. So choose to listen to the word of Yahweh, leaders of Sodom, the scorched and burning. Listen intently, perceiving what is said, and then respond appropriately to the Torah, to the teaching, guidance, and direction and instruction of our God, you people of Amora. Amora is the depressed habitation which deals tyrannically with where people are manipulated. You know, I would say that that's the answer to everything. You know, that... what was the book the traveler through the universe? And he was looking for the ultimate answer, and it turned out to be 42. Hitchhiker's Guide.
Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Yeah, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, and the answer is 42.
Oh, that's
well, I'm here to tell you that the answer is Isaiah 1:10. If you're looking for the answer, it's not 42. It is choose to listen to the word of Yahweh. Anybody who is in a position of authority over a scorched and burning realm, and listen intently. And this would be anybody that's still part of the establishment. Listen intently, perceiving what is said, and then respond appropriately to the Torah guidance of our God. You people of Amora, those people who are manipulated, and so this is both the leaders, the oppressors, and the oppressed. And it's interesting that he says to the leaders, listen to the word of Yahweh as from a prophetic point of view, because what did Yahweh say about human government, and where did he say it?
In Shamuel, he said it's bad news.
Yeah,
they're going to be oppressed. They're going to rob you. They're going to feed
right.
themselves with your food and their servants. They're going to get the best of what you got.
Well,
they're
it's interesting that he said, listen to the word of Yahweh, not to the Torah, you leaders. So Shamuel is not part of the Torah. He's telling the leaders to listen to what he had to say about government in Shamuel. And then the people who are oppressed, the people who are dealt with tyrannically, the people who are being manipulated, he's saying, I want you to listen and respond to my Torah. Because it doesn't matter how much you're manipulated or abused by man, if you listen to intently and respond to the Torah's presentation of the covenant, nothing that an oppressed government can do to you matters in the long run. So this is one of those things where it wasn't, if you don't take the time to figure out, well, what does Amora mean? What does Sodom mean? Who's he talking to? And why did he provide a different thing for each of those two groups? I think the answer is obvious.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're a leader, you ought to know that God does not endorse government. In fact, he is universally opposed to it. And be forewarned. And if you're one of those people who are oppressed, understand that God is saying, disassociate from them. Don't pay allegiance to them. Don't pay homage to them. Don't be part of their military. Don't be part of their political schemes. Don't be part of their religious schemes. Listen intently and respond appropriately to the covenant. Everything will be fine. So it's a very clear and differentiated thing to do, depending on who you are. Then the next statement that Yahweh makes, which I mean, almost anything at this point is can't be as powerful as that one statement, because there is just nothing that God can say that's going to make as big a difference. But he then says, by what means, and now he's talking to the people at large, by what means can I be approached through the great multitude and exalted aspects, even the rabbinic nature, the rab, of your sacrifices, asks Yahweh. I have literally and actually fulfilled, I have satisfied and I have completed the uplifting offering to rise of the lambs. And in addition, the lipid tissue of the fatlings, overfed fatlings, and the blood of bulls, lambs, and goats, I do not desire. This is was a passage that is really screwed up in English translations, because they don't know where one sentence ends and where the next sentence begins and what God is actually saying. The first part of it is pretty clear. What makes you think that I want your sacrifices? You know, it's the religious thing that people think that if they make a big donation, they make a sacrifice, that somehow God's going to view that favorably. And God says, why do you think I want this? Do you think that God is running a deficit like the U.S. government?
God's broke.
Do you
he does not know how to manage his money.
Okay.
Short on cash.
You think that money he needs? He needs blood, apparently.
Yeah, well, yes. But first, do you think God needs money? Do you think he has a use for money? And do you think that he wants blood?
No.
No.
I don't even think he endorses money. So what do you think of that? You know,
yeah,
I mean, it's just
that's why when in that one line is really clever. He's talking when he's asked about the taxes to Rome. He says, "Whose likeness is on that coin?" And I said, "Well, Caesar's." "Well, then, come on to Caesar's. What's Caesar's?" He says, "No, I don't want your money. God never once asked us for money. This whole idea of the tithe being money that you're supposed to give to some human institution so that they can have a paid clergy is wrong on all accounts."
I think he called it beggary. He called it beggary.
Yeah. Why do I want this beggary from your hand? And then, but even the, you know, no matter what it is, because you had so many cultures that were sacrificing children to their gods. Now, we were in Hawaii, and we went to a place on the Big Island where a priest got together with one of the kings, and they figured out, yeah, I got a great way we can control everybody. And that is, we'll set up a bunch of taboos that this is only legal for the priest and for the king. And anybody that violates any of these taboos, we will behead. And they beheaded tens of thousands of people. And sometimes they would cut out their hearts while they were still beating. And, you know, it's this marriage of clergy and king that has been so savage. And, you know, they made these sacrifices, the Incas, the Aztecs, the Romans, the Greeks. They just found a grave on Mount Olympus where the Greeks sacrificed children to appease their gods. And so God said,
some god.
Yeah.
Some god.
I don't. Yeah. I do not want this stuff. I don't even have any idea why you think that this was a good idea. I cannot be approached by the multitude and magnitude of your sacrifices. And then he says, you know, who told you this? You know, I just told you to listen to me. I sure as hell didn't tell you this. Then he says, I've actually fulfilled, satisfied, and completed the uplifting offering to rise of the male lambs. Peace on. Now, this was written.
Yeah, he says that again in Jeremiah, too. It's Yashiah. That's right.
Right. This is 745 BCE. He didn't fulfill it personally until 33 CE. Remember when I said we began this program, I said that Yahweh meets most of us somewhere along the way. You know, in Abram's case, it was in Haran. And various of us, he meets somewhere along the way. Mm-hmm. And you wonder, well, how can he do that when you know, we haven't yet come to know and acted upon the terms and conditions of the covenant? And the answer is that once you're a member of Yahweh's family, and with the case with Yahweh himself, the ordinary flow of time becomes irrelevant. We are no longer stuck in the ordinary flow of time. So since we have become, and Yahweh knew we'd become his children by acting upon the terms and conditions of the covenant, then he can do anything he wants in advance of that because we've already done it. And so we're no longer stuck in the ordinary flow of time. That's why it works that way. Now, in the case here, where I was saying I've already fulfilled the sacrifice of the lambs. Well, this was 745 BCE. He was going to do it in exactly 777 years in 33 CE. But from his perspective, he is not stuck in time. He's a seven-dimensional being that is akin to light, and on light there is no past, present, and future. You're no longer constrained by time.
Well, you're talking about relativity there. Yeah, I get that.
You're no longer constrained by time. He is not constrained by time. And since he transforms his children into light, into his nature, we aren't constrained by time. And so when he says, I've already done this, he already had.
Yeah, well, it's like, you know, when you look, you know, it's funny to me, too, how many people that follow Judaism don't get that when you say it. So what do you mean? That hadn't happened yet. They'll talk like that. And you'll be like, wow, you're really not getting this, and you're not going to get it until you walk out of religion. But I just want to throw that in. I've actually had them tell me that, and I just say, wow. You don't get it. I said, what do you think a prophecy is about? I mean,
right.
That's how he proves
it. The key thing about prophecy is that when you understand that God is not predicting the future. His prophecy has nothing
back.
To do with predicting the future. What he is doing is he has witnessed the summation of our choices and reporting what he has witnessed in our past, so that when there are thousands upon thousands of these, we can use logic to deduce the fact that these were inspired by a being that's not constrained by time. And so prophecy works exactly the same way as what we're talking about now. God is not
Jeremiah,
by time.
He talked about knowing Jeremiah from the time he was in the womb. And years ago, I tried to figure out what does that mean? Well, I know now, that Yahweh isn't micromanaging our decisions. He's not commanding us to love him.
He wasn't chatting with Jeremiah in the womb.
Right.
I knew him before he was even born, because I'm not stuck in time.
Yeah, because I know him now. I knew him then. Get this. Check this out. Yeah, because he made decisions on his own to walk towards Yahweh, and Yahweh knew that, of course, from his perspective.
Anyway, this is so important. They discovered that there's a rocky planet in the Goldilocks zone around Proxima Centauri. Proxima Centauri is the closest star to our solar system. And at the speed of light, I think it is somewhere around a 1,000 years to get to Proxima Centauri, and it's like 1,000 years to get back to Proxima Centauri. We ain't going there. Now, that's the closest star to our sun. So long as we have a physical body and we are constrained by the ordinary flow of time, there is nothing in this universe outside of this planet that we will ever be able to see. But Proxima Centauri is it is only 4.25 light years away, but it is if we were to travel the same speed as the Apollo 11 that went to the moon, then it would take 1,000 years. So at the speed of Apollo 11, it would take at the speed of Apollo 11, it would take a 1,000 years to get there, and which is the fastest man has ever gone. While we are physical beings and therefore constrained in time, even though from Yahweh's perspective our soul is not, we couldn't even get to Proxima Centauri, much less see any other part of the Milky Way galaxy, much less see any one of the 100 billion other galaxies. And that's going to be a huge part of the fun of eternity, is not only going off and seeing these galaxies, but seeing life forms and being able to experiment and to try things and to compare and to share. And none of it's possible while we're constrained in the ordinary flow of time. You have to become an energy spiritual-based being where you could get from one side of the universe to the other, 30 billion light years across, in no time. Because, speed is distance over time, but if time becomes irrelevant, then speed's irrelevant. Distance is irrelevant. So it's a huge part of what God is offering to us. Now, what's interesting here is that there are really three statements here, and I don't think there's an English translation that captures them. The first is, who in the world is the one that told you that somehow that I could be approached through these sacrifices of yours? And then the second is, so I'm telling you, if you want to listen to my Torah, then I will tell you what you need to do to approach me. And there's five conditions. You do those five things, and we're all set. Even the sacrifice for Passover, for example, when you're attending Passover as part of walking to me and being perfect, you aren't sacrificing anything, because last time I checked, you do need to eat. And of the sacrificial lamb, 100% of the edible portions of the sacrificial lamb, the people eat. All that is given to God is, he says, the parts that are unedible, I always want you to burn up in the fire at the end of the at the end of Passover. And it wasn't just because they were unedible and he didn't want his family eating things that weren't good for them. It was symbolic to say, when I, as Yosha, fulfill Pesach, and I sacrifice that my physical body is the sacrificial lamb, at the end of Pesach, I'm going to eradicate, I'm going to completely incinerate the remains of that body, because that body has served its function. And so this idea of bodily resurrection is destroyed by that particular...
Yeah, it does away with the zombie Jesus thing.
Correct. And it's absolutely essential because of what we're talking about here. If we were resurrected into a physical body, we would gain nothing. We gain nothing. I mean, can you imagine an eternity in a physical body? You couldn't go anywhere. You couldn't travel anywhere. You'd still be stuck on the same rock that you were on. You could never leave that rock. Now, imagine spending billions and billions of years and never being able to leave this planet. Good God, it'd be miserable. So it's essential that you understand that we're not going to have a physical body, and that's how we're going to be able to maneuver in time. Now, the third aspect of this is that it's important to understand that God has no interest in blood. He has no interest in a sacrificial animal. He's not eating them. He finds no pleasure in them being killed. 100% of his feast, the purpose of the sacrifice is to feed the family, is to nurture the family. And so all of this is designed to expose and condemn religion. So then he says, because if you strive to approach, if you want to approach to see my presence, who or what is it that sought this beggary from your hand, thereby treading upon the blowing of my trumpets in my court? So God is asking again, you know, I told you to listen to my Torah, prophets, and songs. I don't ask you for any of this. So you ought to be asking yourself, since I'm rejecting it, and since you have no chance of seeing me by doing it, who was it that asked you to do this? And then when you know the answer to that question, don't trust them. That's the implication here. And it's got to say, do you think I can be bought? Do you think that if you sacrifice 10 lambs that I'm going to be impressed with you, that somehow is going to... You think I can be bribed? You think that if you make a really big donation to the church, I'm going to be impressed? I mean, do you really think I can be bribed?
Yeah. No. There's 100 people that's stupid.
Ransom.
You know that, right?
The creator of the universe is so impressed by how much money you make that he can't believe it. And that you're willing to give up that small portion of it to help someone else.
James, I want you to give me the entire list of people that were merchants that were extremely successful financially. Merchants that God says, you know, I think what I need to do now is I'm going to reveal my next set of prophecy by going to somebody who is really, really rich. Can you give me that list?
It's an empty list.
Okay. Why don't you tell me the people he approached that at the time that he approached them were were either a military or a political leader?
Not a one.
How about a religious leader?
Hell no.
Nope.
Yeah, none. Ever. And so, he's actually impressed by work. He likes work. But he's not impressed by wealth or any of these things. Now, the blowing of my trumpet.
A perfect example is Moshe. Moshe grew up in a wealthy home, in a very religious home, and God had nothing to do with him until he was a lonely shepherd.
That is correct. You know, I recall that at one time in my life, I had some pretty good-sized businesses that were worth a lot of money, and I had lots of employees. I didn't meet God during that time. But when I was done with them, and they were done with me, and I had the joy of being publicly humiliated with a being on the cover of a national periodical. It was shortly after that that he says, you know, we might get along.
Maybe
great.
We can do something with
if
this
you,
guy
if
now.
If you can survive this, dude, you're my kind of guy. By the way, they didn't treat me any better. So, you know, that's just his, that is his style. Now, so what is the trumpets? You know, this is in Numbers 10, 1 through 3. It said, make two trumpets constructed of silver. You should use them to call out the invitations to the mikre and journey to the next encampment. Then he says, blowing the trumpets before the ark of God at the doorkeepers of the ark. The trumpets, therefore, are a call to the mikre. So he says, you know, you're besmirching. What you're doing is in opposition to treading upon the blowing of my trumpet. So in my court, so if you don't look at, okay, when did he mention trumpets in connection with his court? All you have to do is we're reading the Ashiyah, turn back to the Torah. And this is you have no chance of understanding without making the connection. Turn back to the Torah, what do you find? In the Torah, he says, I want you to make trumpets. Oh, okay, we got trumpets. Then he says, here's what I want you to use them. I want you to use them to announce my mikrei. Well, he's just condemned religious sacrifices. And he says, your religious sacrifices are in conflict with, they tread upon, my mikrei. That's why he used this terminology. And then he tied it, went one step further. There is a direct tie-in between the seven Moed Mikrei, particularly the first four, and the terms and conditions and the benefits of the covenant. The five benefits of the covenant are provided by the first four Mikrei. And so he didn't just say that these trumpets are to announce my Mikrei, but also says I want them blown before my ark. What is the ark? The Ark of the Covenant.
That's what it's telling him. Also,
I mean, yeah, so he said, here's your comparison. You got your religious sacrifices, and I'm telling you that it's beggary. I'm telling you that I don't want them. They don't impress me. You're never going to get my attention or come into my presence doing them. And they're in conflict with, they tread upon my mikre. They tread upon my covenant. Now, to get there, you got to actually do some thinking, but it is pretty darn clear. It even says, you know, I want you to do this before the doorkeepers. Well, when God speaks of a door, how many doors are there in His Torah?
One.
Yeah, there's. Blake was holding up three fingers, and he's right, and you know, both are right.
Door options, but
there are three doors on that ark. There are three locations where souls can go. You can either go into Yahweh's home, which there is only one door there. That is the Passover door. So there's only one door that matters. That's Passover. But there are, he says doorkeepers, plural. So I'm going to say
you do have the three.
Here.
You have the three because there's people entering into Sheol and others saying I don't want to die. I just don't want to.
By the way, the doorway to annihilation and the doorway to Sheol. Those are Yahweh's doors. He controls those doors.
Fair enough. Yeah.
Yep.
Well, Blake, thanks, man. You got it right.
Yeah, man. I try. Yeah, there you go. All right. He says, you should not increasingly and habitually come bringing devastatingly worthless, completely invalid, and deceptively futile tributes, gifts, and offerings. How many times? Do you think you could go to a church service where somebody doesn't say, yeah, no, it's going to collect the tithes and offerings?
No.
When Scientology was created on a bet, do you think that it exists right now because it's not profitable? when Mormonism decided, you know, what we're going to do is we're just going to tax your income. We're going to take 10% of your earnings. What God is saying is, are you nuts? Why are you continually habitually come to bring these devastatingly worthless, completely invalid, and deceptively futile tributes, gifts, and offerings? I mean, can you imagine God saying, you know what I really want? Is that fiat currency of the United States. I mean, it's a liability. They're $20 trillion in debt.
Important to me.
What I really want, I really want some of those.
Because well, apparently God can't create anymore. Did you not know this? Like he's unable to create, and he needs our money.
Yeah, he needs our money.
This is what's happening. So yeah. That's why he's asking for tithes.
Yeah,
he figured it out.
My guess is that it's expensive. God valued gold so much, he would have made more of it.
See? Yeah. What do you think he's... Can you imagine? He knows the future before it happens, and he's obviously not playing the stock market when he knows the future before it happens. Do you think he needs money?
No.
If you knew what was happening, going to happen a year, 2, 5, and 10 years from now, and you knew everything that you wanted to know about what was going to happen, would you need money?
No.
No. Create money. What do you care? You're saying, come on. You're saying it's futile. It's stupid. You know, plus the fact, it goes back to the story I've told, you know, 100 times. It was one of the most embarrassing moments of my life. My first job, I'm with the president of the company. He takes me out to his country club. We go out and play golf. And at the end of the round, we sit in the clubhouse and... He saddled up to the bar, and he says, yep, we'd like, he asked me if I wanted a beer. I said, yes. I pulled out a quarter, because that's what beers cost at my fraternity, out of my pocket, and I said, let me pay for this.
Brilliant. You know, I'll be honest with you, Craig, even then I would have expected more out of you than that, really.
Well, of course. I tell the story because it's so devastatingly stupid. But how was that any different than Yahweh saying, you know, I'm going to become the Passover lamb. I'm going to have my soul go down to matzah to liberate you, justly resolve the dispute so that you don't have to go there. And, oh, by the way, I really want you to make a contribution. This was the best I could do, but I maybe if you could throw in a few quarters, maybe 75 cents even.
10%.
I need 10%
free tax.
Well, I mean, you're looking at it from a rational point of view, and you know most people don't. You know, the religious idea, and this is where they get them, is based on your personal sacrifice. Even though they claim, you know, this is all a free gift, you know, you really have to get out there and sacrifice for that free gift, right? I mean, that's
what... the thing is that money, when it comes down to it, thought is hard. But possessions are easy enough to give up. It's easy enough to present a concept of sacrifice because people are willing to do it. It's really easy to do that. But to actually think about it and to approach it from a logical standpoint is difficult. So people shy away. You know, they
don't want to go through it logically and say, wait a minute, making a sacrifice to God is an absolute, utter stupid thing to do, because there is nothing that tangible that you can give him that he would want. Now, there is one thing he wants.
It makes them feel good.
He wants you to engage. He wants you to come to know him. He wants you to respond and accept the gift that he's offering. So he there's a lot that he wants from us, like a proper attitude, like for us to trust him, like for us to walk with him and listen to him. He's got no interest in us making a sacrifice on his behalf. You know, the moron that we were lambasting in our program a week ago that with the Enocher, Mr. Enocher.
Yeah, he has a special
Mr. Enocher used this section of Isaiah to say, see, God is telling you that he is disgusted with your religious holidays. And he said that was written for us. Because
you know, and that's one more example of his stupidity.
He is. I went and looked at his site, and he's got, you know, on FB, he's got like 2,500 people. And it's a mishmash of lost religious people that go in there and say, oh, thank you, thank you, thank you for accepting my friendship. And then you'll see, you know, amen. You've got people using the term holy all over the place. It's just really, really a bad, just kind of a eclectic religious
The basic premise of it is that the Torah was incomplete. It didn't have a calendar. No, that's not true. The Torah does have a calendar. And so his premise is that the Torah is incomplete. It's inadequate. And that the solution to that is this piece of trash known as Enoch.
I know, but they all need a secret. They need a special secret, these people. They've always had it. Every time you get into it with them, they know something special. Do you know what they were using to back up Enoch and his group, by the way? You want a real good laugh?
Oh, yeah.
Ready?
I like that.
The Book of Jubilee, because it talks about the 52 weeks. So we're supposed to be
another
impressed that somebody, you know, a few hundred years ago knew there were 52 weeks in a year. I mean, is that all you got? Really? I mean, come on.
To back up one book that's been dismissed, you cite another book that has been universally dismissed.
You know,
yeah,
there's
that
only
makes a lot of sense.
Last time I checked, Yahweh proved that he authored the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. And in the Torah, he has a test. He presents it twice in Devarim and in the Torah as to whether to use, and it's the only test that he has. Is both presented in Devarim. The tests are really the same. He says, if you're wondering, if you're curious as to whether or not something is from me, you check it out through the lens of Jubilee. No. Here are the conditions. And one of the conditions is that it has to be consistent with what he has said. Another one of the conditions, it has to be accurate historically. And the third condition, it has to be accurate prophetically. And, for example, Paul's letters. He only has one prophecy. He got it wrong. It means that you use the test and you can immediately determine whether or not God inspired something. The Torah is filled with accurate prophecies, has none that is inaccurate. Yahshua Isaiah is probably the most interesting in terms of accurate prophecies, that and Daniel. God's trademark is, he says, you know, that's the one thing, that's something I can do that doesn't interfere with free will, that if you take the time to observe what I have said and you think about it and you compare it to history, you can use that to prove with absolute confidence beyond any doubt that I exist and that I inspired this, and you can use that same test to determine what I did not inspire. And that, like, for example, James, you went through in great detail the test that Yahweh had and Devarim, and applied it to Enoch, and, well, Enoch destroys itself 1,000 times over before that, but it failed every one of the tests.
Yeah.
So, for some reason,
yeah, I don't know if you saw the email I sent back to Wayne, but yeah, I included about 15 to 20 of the most ridiculous and contradictory things that Enoch has that contradict the Torah. And his response was, well, because they used the wrong name, my translation was bad. Yeah, never mind, there's not a good translation out there because there's no Hebrew to translate it from. You know, you have a handful of verses in Aramaic in the Dead Sea Scrolls, and then you have this Ethiopian text, but my translation was bad because, you know, he found some translation that replaced it with good names. You know, I bet if you put it word for word, the only thing different, you know, kind of like the ISR translation of the Bible that's out there, where, yeah, they get the names right. Everything else is still pretty much straight from a King James Bible, but they get the names right. So that translation must be accurate.
James, I thought that I liked the mountain made of oysters, or pearls, rather. And then I liked that, and I liked the storehouses. But the more I thought about it, you know, and I was thinking about that work you did this week, and I went and read it over. I liked the little baby that comes out of the womb talking with shining eyes
that
lights the room up. Yeah, Abraham, it's like because it didn't remind me of the crime. He goes out and he argues with an entire village when he's 2 years old.
Kept reminding me time and time again of going through the Quran. I mean, it was like
it does.
The same level of stupidity.
Well, I mean, that's right there. That's almost one gets a little more ridiculous than the other, and in this case, the book of Enoch was worse than the Quran. I mean, at least a 2-year-old could talk, you know. I mean,
it makes sense, though, because the book of Enoch, we know, was written in around, maybe 300 BCE at the latest. So it would have been written by the same people who were writing the Talmud, which is what inspired Muhammad. So, it makes sense that they would be similar.
Mm-hmm. That is correct. Now, this this next line is devastating for all of the Indian religions and also Roman Catholicism. Incense is a detestable abomination to me.
Right.
Yep.
I cannot comprehend, I cannot endure, I cannot overcome. This is Lo Yakol. The deceptive and disastrous falsifications associated with your oppressive and lifeless religious assemblies, which hinder and which withhold the benefits of the time of renewal and the Shabbat and the calling out of the Mikre invitations to meet. This first verb is so stunningly devastating. So God is saying by Lo Yakol, he's saying that your corruptions, your counterfeits, your replacements for my Shabbat, your replacements for my seven Mikra, I don't even comprehend. They are so stupid. They're incomprehensible. Okay, so that's
you'd have to grow up
in
sun-dried bricks to get it, you know.
Right, it's absolutely incomprehensible. Now, God's pretty smart. If God says it's incomprehensible, it's stupid. Number two, he says, I cannot endure. That means that you want to know what Eden's like? No religion. You want to know what heaven's like? No religion. He says, I can't endure that stuff. This is religious stuff. He says, I can't endure it. That means you'll never find God in a mosque. You'll never find God in a church. You'll never find God in a temple. I cannot endure it. The third thing is the most amazing of all. Lo Yakol means I cannot overcome.
Yeah, that's frightening.
Now, that means that God is a means of perfection, of Pesach and Matzah, where he takes us from mortal to immortal, takes us from flawed, from imperfect, if you will, to perfect. He says that won't work on religion. I can't overcome religion. That's why the first condition of the covenant is to walk away from Babel, from these kinds of corruptions, because God's saying, I can do a lot of things for you. I cannot overcome religion. And the reason he says I can't overcome religion is that a religious person is irrational. A religious person will cling to the religion beyond all else. And God says, I can't endure their religion. I can't endure being around it. I can't comprehend it. I'm not going to be driven crazy about it. I'm not going to spend my eternity with it. And since the religious person won't let go of it, I can't do anything for them.
I'm just not going to be around them.
Can I ask you a question?
I can't resolve their problem. That's why, Larry, when you mentioned that Moshe, when he was empowered, when he was a general, when he was religious, when he was in the Pharaoh's family, God didn't meet with him in Egypt.
I think it was J.B. that mentioned that.
J.B., that's right. He was a lowly shepherd.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing here. God saying, even with Abraham, he didn't go to Babel to meet with Abraham. It's only when he left Babel that he met with him. God's saying, if you're religious, I can't help you. Now, I want to take that one step further, and then I do need to leave. I'm going to let you guys have the last 20 minutes. If God, who is much smarter than we are, if God, who is much more influential than we are, if God, who authored this entire solution on how to resolve human imperfections,
If God says, I cannot overcome religious stupidity, what do you think the odds are of us being able to do it?
They're nil, pal.
Absolutely nil. Zero.
Right. I had a good friend that called me a couple of days ago, a doctor in Arizona. Maybe he's listening here to this program. He's become part of the group that is coordinated around this show with Frank. And by the way, Diane, Frank's wife, had her surgery, and extraordinarily successful. Not only extraordinarily successful, it was Diane's attitude that was so impressive, that was a huge part of her of the success of the operation. But you know, that really is a result of being part of Yahweh's family. This fellow, he asked me, good friend, I've known him for a long time. He says, you know, here are some objections of religious people. And we went through each of them and said, showed how they were nonsense. But I said, now that I've done that, I've just said, I did this for you. Don't expect that any of these rational answers are going to work with them. If you're still religious, if you don't take the first step and walk away from religion, there is a 0% chance that anything that God has to say is going to resonate with you. If God can't overcome
it, you don't have a chance.
Right. Don't waste your time.
There's always a faith-based answer. And when there's a faith-based answer that always comes up, reason goes right out the window. Therefore, everything you're saying is moot.
That is correct. So don't even bother.
Yep. There's an aspect to these people that I run into all the time. The reason I kept bringing up the difference between Shabbat and Moed is the very same people, of course, he was accusing us of being lunar Shabbat people. Where he gets that, I have no idea. We use the sun and the moon to figure out when to have a mikre. That's
right.
Completely different than a Shabbat. You have to be able to count to seven to get to the Shabbat. But
right.
I know
it's
a real difficult mikre.
Yeah, you have to use the sun and the moon, and God gives you the
yeah, but they go to Bereshith there. They go to Bereshith, where you point out that, you know, these are symbols and signs,
right.
You know, important symbols and signs, and they're used for the purposes of the Moed. It says that right there. Well, there's a lunar Shabbat group that takes that, and that means that's when the Shabbat is, using the moon, you see.
Yeah, most of the Shabbat.
And that's why I was pointing out last week the difference between Shabbat and Moed. I mean, if you can't see the difference, then you're probably pretty hopeless anyway.
Yeah, I would like to ask you a question. You know, well, the Shabbat is important to you. What do you think is more important, that you to be part of His covenant family, that you walk to God and become perfect through the Moed Mikre, or that you celebrate the Shabbat the same time that he celebrates the Shabbat?
The former.
Is there a reference anywhere in the conditions of the covenant to the time that you celebrate? Did Yahweh, where he is, his Shabbat's important because it's this promise of seven and everything. That if you want to understand who he is and what he's doing, you do need to understand the promise of seven. We're going to be taken to the seventh dimension, and there's the path to that is the seven Moed Mikre. But does he ever once say that my problem with you is that you're celebrating the Shabbat on the wrong day?
No.
Did he ever say, you know, the problem with Israel is that you're celebrating the Moed Mikre on the wrong day? You know, here he's lambasting.
No, he said you corrupted
Israel. He said, you know, your sacrifices are meaningless to me. I don't want this beggary. I can't endure it. I can't resolve it. I can't overcome it. Did he once say that it's because you're celebrating my mikre on the wrong day?
No, he doesn't. He doesn't say that.
So why would somebody get so tied up on the day as opposed to the meaning?
Because they have to have a new deal. They have to, instead of looking at the words, see, your approach, and it has become a lot of our approaches, has to seriously consider Yahweh's very direct words. And we come to find out he doesn't dance around issues. He's real straightforward. I mean, this isn't as eye-opening as this is, or as it, to us, I mean, it may not seem to be that big a deal. To most people, it would have to be a big deal that he could say something like, they have literally become an annoying problem to me. You know, because if yeah. you went to the religious book, it would probably say something completely different, and
oh,
it would be fashioned in some
yeah,
high tone.
In the big chapter, when this is all published, and I think Richard has it up in his site now, and Frank does as well, and I also think that it's on the Cara site of Don. But when what you'll find is that because the English translations are so horrible of this section of Yashayah, because this section of Yashayah is so overtly condemning of religion, that I methodically compare them just because I think it's important for people to see here's how English Bibles have hoodwinked people into coming to the wrong conclusion about all of this. Anyway, guys, you've got 15 minutes. I have to go. I'm going to let you finish the show. I've enjoyed this immensely, and we'll talk with you next week.
Yeah, Shabbat Shalom.
Good. See you later.
Okay. All right. Bye, guys.
Can I throw something into y'all before we got about 15 minutes?
Yeah. Go ahead, Kurt.
Sure. You know, the conversation we had on where we are right now at 113, and I translated that. I went back and I translated every way I could with my whatever my resources are. And the last three words where it says Yokel Awan and Atsara, Yokel, of course, is to have power to endure, and he says Lo Yokel, so it means I don't have the power to overcome it. So he's, and there's no other way you can translate that. Anywhere I look, it says exactly the same thing. I cannot endure it. And if you're thinking about something like a, I don't know, whatever similar you could be talking about, but he makes that very clear. The one, of course, is wickedness, idolatry, iniquity. And then you go to a star, and here's everything I found on the star. So we obviously know which kind of assembly he's talking about. He says it's a sacrifice assembly for Baal. If you study a little bit more and dig up a little bit more, it's an assembly of deceivers. From a star, which means to bind, to restrict, to detain, to confine, to retain, like in prison. And then if you look up to bind, of course, we have the wonderful Latin word religion. And then you go to everything to the root, and it's still the same thing. It's the root word from the first word, yoko, was I cannot overcome. I don't have the ability to overcome, to perform your improper actions. And then you move on to the next, the last one again, and it's once again, you find it in every place I went. It all comes down to restrain, cause to cease, failed assemblies. If you translate it, you can't find anything. It's not even an alternative to find. So you have to just make it up something.
Well, and I think they do just make up.
Well, they have to, because sometimes you have two words, you know, and you can pick the wrong word for your own advantage, but... I couldn't even find anything to support anything other than exactly the way he translated it. So,
well, you know, if you're trying to establish a religious organization that boards over people and requires sacrifice and money, this is about the last thing you'd want them to see, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, straight up. I mean, you know, this beggary of yours and these religious prayers of yours and all this nonsense of yours is so stupid to me. Instead of looking at my mikre and what they represent, you know, that I think you're so stupid, you're beyond my help. And I think a lot of that also comes not just from laziness. You know, I mean, how many times did you hand somebody yada yada? And they said, well, you know, I started to read it. You know, I mean, this is pithy stuff.
I don't have time for that.
Yeah, that's right. That's your typical... And so
my response to that is, how many hours a week do you spend in church? The average person spends 2 to 3 hours a week in church. Spend that time reading this book. You spend 3 hours a week reading yada yada, you'll finish it in about a month and a half, 2 months max, depending on how fast you read. So you're out of 2 months worth of church. Yeah, what did you lose?
Yeah.
Well, I agree with that, but then you've also got... beyond that, you've also got societal norms. In other words, you know, let's say I'm going to use my kids as an example. Let's say I bring up reality versus religion to my kids, and I do this when I see them. You know, and I do it less and less now. They just don't. You know, maybe one day one of them will want to hear it. I don't know. You know, I didn't know what I know now when I raised them. You understand that. There's a pretty big difference. You know, and so none of my kids are religious, but they are political or patriotic and things like that. And, you know, and caught up in the day-to-day minutia of their career choices and things like that. And I think that that's where most people really are. They're caught up in how is their business doing, how is their personal business doing, where's the party this weekend, right? You know, is it at the beach or wherever you're grilling out or whatever the thing is, where we're putting an inordinate amount of time into just, you know, sharing words. And that's what we do, share words. I mean, that's all we can. It's the best we're ever going to do. And maybe some concepts. But we throw them out there to people. And these are the things that societally are really taboo now. Because you're supposed to be out at the, you know, grilling and worrying about who won the volleyball game or whatever. You understand what I'm saying. It's a combination of things. And I think most people decide not to look, and the religious are just simply retarded. I mean, if anybody really thought about it, and y'all was saying, what's this beggary? You're going to give me money, you know, I own all the cows. Believe me. You know, I mean, I own the universe. You're just a speck in the universe. And you think that your phony money accounts to me, but come on, there's entire institutions, religious organizations based on exactly that, the giving of money.
Well, let me ask you something. The you expect poor translations from the Christian community.
Yes, I do.
It's Roman Catholic, even if it's Protestant, it's still Roman Catholic.
Yes, I do, yes.
However, this is every translation I made here recently has been started out of the Masoretic text, which is Hebrew as it can get, and is exactly as they write it down exactly as I'm giving it to you.
I don't get that part.
Even in the Yehudim or the Jewish community, as we call them now, they don't read the Torah either.
No, they don't.
They just the rabbi must not let them. My wife would tell you, growing up Catholic, you know, they didn't let you read the Bible.
If you think about rabbinic Judaism, you know, rabbis make a lot of money coming in, blessing your home, or checking to see if you got any leaven in it around Pesach and all this stuff. And, you know, there's tons of money involved in any religion. I mean, and power.
Yeah.
Right?
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
well, the whole organization collapses if you can't get money. Nobody's going to get free.
Exactly. And that's why it's funny. There's so many people that call us a cult, you know.
Yeah, well, I don't know where the power is or where anything. Ain't nothing here.
Every time I turn around, Greg's asking me for another donation.
Yeah. Well, you know, Sandy recently, you know, she's Covenant over there in Louisiana. She got flooded out.
Yes.
And D Powers had put up a thing saying, you know, just a GoFundMe account, just, you know, to help out a little bit with Sandy's situation there with the flood.
Absolutely.
And which is good, you know, and everybody stepped up. I think we raised about a little over $3,500 in a few days. And interestingly, somebody who wanted to attack D had shown this as, look how they're collecting money. And then they accused, now get this, they accused Sandy of being a lizard person.
a lizard person,
no less. You know, so, you know, is there any way to get to people like that? Oh, hell no. I mean, no. Of course. They're insane. I mean,
it only makes the point stronger. If y'all can't figure out, can't help them, How the heck are you?
You can't.
You know, I find that rather comforting.
Well, I found it comforting, that I know lizard people. I didn't think
that. I do, so.
Yeah, I thought I'd have to wait until the next dimension to meet a lizard person. It turns out they're walking right around amongst us. You know, it's just
they're running the world apparently.
Yeah, that's the story.
Who are these?
It's unbelievable. And now, of course, the woman that pushes this, by the way, this goes hand in glove with what we're talking about. Her name is Sherry Schreiner. This was her group. And she sells these, they're these rocks, they're Oregon.
You had me dismissing her as soon as you said she sells.
Yeah, I'm like, okay,
I have no interest in this person.
Well, of course not, but she sells Oregon blasters, and that will keep
Oregon
you safe.
Blasters.
Yeah, yeah, it'll keep you safe from lizard people and aliens. And yeah, this is no kidding now.
You know
and
what? I'm going to take my chance. Thousands
of
lizard people and aliens.
Oh, it's pretty outrageous. And they actually buy into it. And of course, she claims that she's one of Yahweh's actual daughters. Because he actually gave birth, in the spiritual realm, he's got a few kids, and she's one of them.
Right. Well, you know, P.T. Barnum put it best. There's a sucker born every day, and she is making her money on them.
Yeah. Well, I think it's mainly schizophrenics and stuff like that that she makes her money on. I mean, and because they really believe it. You know, I mean, it takes a special sort of person to get out there and believe that there are shape-shifting lizard people out there. I mean, I just want to throw that out there.
People have gone full retard.
Yeah, well, yeah, sure. But, I mean, you would have thought, you know, because Yahweh talks about in the latter time how he has his two witnesses, you know, Yahweh and Enoch, you know, in the end there. He didn't come back to...
Well, he didn't call out Enoch's name, but, I mean, we suspect
well,
he would
yeah,
be...
Yeah,
he really not
there he is.
I understand. That's my thought. But, you know, he failed to tell us about his daughter that was going to come back and sell Oregon blasters.
Well, thank you.
Multiple daughters, apparently.
Well, he had multiple sons, and I think only one daughter, and she was the one daughter. She used to be a Moloch.
The only daughter. She's very special.
Yeah, right. I mean, she used to be a Moloch, and now she's a regular human being selling books on the religious books on the planet.
You know, there was a time when people like that would be put into an institution that could possibly help them or at least keep them from endangering society.
Yeah, I think Jimmy Carter did.
Unfortunately, now we just let him run.
Yeah, I know. I mean, it was just one of these things. You actually see this, and there's actually hundreds of people that believe this, not even thousands.
Yeah.
You know, that believe
that's bizarre. That's just too
crazy. Well, I know. I mean, but it's a hard
thing.
If
anybody's ever taken it serious, isn't that? It's
meanwhile, we're barely in the double digits as far as those who actually know Yahweh.
Yeah, barely. I'm with you, man. I know. It's a sad state of affairs. But then that goes hand in glove with what he said, where his mercy's for thousands. So I feel very comfortable in this position, and I know you guys do, too. You know, because there's just no way that we could be a part of any movement or, you know, religious group. Or
no,
something.
There's nowhere to go. There's nothing to spend money on. It's just follow the words and contribute.
And by the way, as far as I know, she's not a nut.